Welcome to Turning Point, a podcast dedicated to sharing the always inspiring, sometimes heartbreaking stories of people working in the social services profession. We'll be hearing stories of triumph over incredible odds, as well as the setbacks and challenges that people face along the way. We'll hear from people working in addiction and mental health, residential treatment programs, and community-based services, as well as some of the clients that those people serve. We'll be focusing on how to increase your impact as a professional and the role of helping people overcome their own challenges through stories of impactful moments, both in treatment and in life. We'll hear tips, tools, strategies, and resources that you can apply to your own practice starting today. Turning Point is brought to you by Enviros, a diverse social services organization dedicated to strengthening youth and families in Alberta through a unique and powerful combination of experiential, strengths-focused, family-centered programming. You can learn more at www.enviros.org. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Coulard. This is a really special episode. This was recorded actually about a year ago with one of my most favorite people, Jeff Wilson, who is the program supervisor up at Shunda Creek. And we sat down when we were in Montreal for the National Addictions Conference, and that was like a year ago. And then we didn't quite finish it, and I sat down again with him at another opportunity, and we recorded a bit more. So it's going to be a little bit disjointed, but Jeff is one of the smartest guys I know. He's been doing this for a really long time, and he's got tons of advice and great words of wisdom on how to run really effective programs for people with addiction and mental health issues. And so, enjoy this episode, and maybe grab a notepad and a pen, because a lot of the bits coming out of Jeff are gold, and you can apply them to your practice starting today. All right, I'm here with Jeff Wilson. What's your current role with Enviros, Jeff?
I'm program supervisor of Shunda Creek Addiction Treatment Center.
Okay, can you tell me a bit more about Shunda Creek, what it is you guys do?
It's a 90-day drug, alcohol, mental health issue treatment program for young adult males, 18 to 24, connected with Alberta Health Services, and we run a wilderness-informed, experiential-based program. Involve clients in their own journey, their own change process.
Okay. And how long have you guys been up and running?
We've been running, we're entering our sixth year.
Okay. So 2009?
2009 was the start date, first contract under Safer Communities.
Okay. And you had previously worked at Enviros, and you came back to start up Shunda Creek in 2009. What were you doing? Can you give us a little bit of background and context as far as what you were?
Around 87, I came back to work, 86, 87, to work at base camp for the young offender, 8-week young offender intensives, and eventually moved to program coordinator of that until the funding got yanked, and then I went over to Trust Treatment Center for about 4 years, so I was with Enviros kind of 86 to 93.
Okay. And then 93 to 2009, what were you up to?
Well, I've been went out on my own. We ran a adventure company, Voyager Canoes, in the summer. Corporate leadership specialty groups in the shoulder seasons and dog sledding in the winter for about, we're still running the dog sledding, but we were independent for about 7 years before I got attracted back to running a couple intensive treatment group homes in Rocky Mountain House while still running the business. So I did that for about 7 years before this job opportunity came up.
And what brought you back to Enviros, or what attracted you to starting up Shunda Creek?
Well, Enviros has always been, to me, a different type of organization. A very open organization to me, where fairly nimble, less administrative intensive. That's what attracted me back to Enviros. The opportunity to design a program from the ground up, obviously at my age, was the deciding factor, and it was close to my home turf. I'd been working in that valley that's where my business ran, so I'd been all through there. So yeah. I had a lot of ideas about what we might do.
Yeah. Cool. We talk about Enviro's programs as being this idea of a turning point for clients. Is that how you would describe the experience of clients at Shenda Creek, or how do you guys kind of conceptualize your role and the work and the program in the journey of the clients that you see?
Well, yeah, I think that I've never bought the notion that you need to, though I know there's a lot of reality to it, that takes clients 4 to 5 treatments before anything takes hold. I think you have to have a bigger dream. So you start with, this can be the one program that creates an opportunity that might allow them to shift from a dysfunctional life to mildly functional. There's still going to be struggles, but I would rather put the onus on us to try to deliver, you can call it the turning point. I think that that's perfectly apt. Or just that shift in their awareness of who they are and who they want to become that can be enough to engage them in the struggle of recovery versus struggling with relapse and staying in the addiction.
We often talk a lot about, and I know at Shenda Creek it's an important piece of the program, is this idea of a shared journey or a parallel process that staff are on. Can you describe a little bit about what you mean by that and how that comes to play for staff? It's a very different work environment than I think most people might think.
Yeah, and I think it's the core, and yeah. It's like all true experiential in wilderness, it is messy. The piece is that you need to break down the power differentials where staff are perceived as the expert and clients are the recipient of their wisdom. There is some truth there that if you hire good staff, they obviously have life experience that can be valuable to the client, but you can't tell anyone anything. So, and that holds true for all people, I believe. So the only way in to tap that wisdom, it remains the client's choice to tap that wisdom, and it all comes down to a true vulnerable relationship. They have to have trust. But beyond that, the staff must be engaged in our feeling in their own continuous journey of growth, and not pretend that they have arrived at a spot where they're the expert. Otherwise, it ultimately turns into telling the client, and all you can really do is share with them what worked for you. Given every client's unique, every human being's unique, all that can be is offering some potential guideposts that the client needs to decide if that works for them or not. It is messy because there's a lot of vulnerability involved in a staff. Okay, I'm supposed to be responsible for their safety. I'm supposed to know what I'm doing here. How does that fit with being vulnerable? And I think the key part is human-to-human, relationship-to-relationship. Vulnerability is really about just being honest with who you are, what you're at, and owning the stories you're developing. If you approach people with a true compassionate inquiry, and you're essentially just checking out perceptions that you're putting together about what's happening with the client, then if there's relationship, if there's trust, they can take that more as information of how they're being perceived by somebody else, not judged by somebody else. So I think that judgment component is the critical turning point for a relationship. The minute anybody feels judged, and I'll say the minute any human being feels judged, their defenses are going to come up, their protective layers, their justifications, their ambivalence, and those are all the words we use for what addicts do.
All those things.
So all we're doing is triggering the addict brain when we judge somebody or shame them.
Yeah. And how do you train that, or how do you get staff awareness around that? Because that seems to me that that's you know, pretty radically different from the approach that the sector usually embraces, which is go and get lots of education so you know lots of things so that you can fix people and help them grow by sharing your wisdom and those pieces. And we don't actually talk a lot about things like vulnerability and things like non-judgment and that. So is there a process that Shenda is just a special type of person? You know, a little insight into
all
that,
of the above. Yeah. I think they're people who are truly interested in just learning, which means they're on their own journey where they don't think they know everything, do get attracted to Shenda. I think it does take tending, evolving first, and then tending a culture that supports the notion of shared journey. And that takes a little bit of time and commitment to really do it. What it involves is a lot of coaching, the ability for staff to reflect for other staff how they're being perceived. Kind of, we need to walk the walk.
Yeah.
You need to practice whatever a client does. Whatever we're asking a client to do, we need to be prepared to engage our own staff in the same thing. One process we have that's worked out quite well at Shenda is the community meeting. And that is structured to put stories on the table and to really facilitate that it's not about pretending to have a level community and then telling the client what they need to do, but to truly have a mechanism where clients can reflect for other clients, seek clarity on what a client meant by something or what their body language meant, but also own the story they created around that, put it on the table to get some clarity. So that can be client to client, staff to client, and where you have to pay critical attention is when a client gives feedback to staff, that staff react with non-judgment and truly take in that information to see what's around it. There might be a gift in it for how the staff is being perceived. We add one additional layer, which took a bit longer to get to, and that's staff to staff in front of the community. We do have one rider. We are human beings. We're going to react to our staff team, particularly in an intense situation, the intense work life that we have out there. Working half their lives out there, staff are going to have occasional differences of opinion, get on each other's nerves a little bit. If that happens in the office setting, it stays in the office setting.
Yeah.
And that's a critical piece. But if a staff's personality conflict or little dealings with another staff come out a little sideways, say at the lunch table, that is now community property. And I would expect that the staff can role model that conflict resolution, that negotiation at the community meeting. And getting past that feeling that you're exposing a staff vulnerability, you need to realize that if it came out sideways at the table, every client created a story, so it's already out there. All you're doing is acknowledging it and clearing it. So it actually does more to take care of the situation than pretending like we can't go there professional.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like you're really looking at building a congruent community. I've heard that kind of language before.
That's what we like to say, that in the congruent community model, it's an ideal that we don't expect you can ever achieve, but you always have to strive for. And that's that every moment of every day is a therapeutic opportunity, and that we are role modeling being conscious in recognizing where our reactions are, taking the pause to consider, okay, I had a feeling, I had a body reaction to that comment, taking the moment to put that in perspective and then decide how you want to respond to that. That would probably be the basis of our self-awareness model of recovery for the client. So we as staff need to also role model that. It would not be unusual for a staff to be completely engaged, picking up with the clients, working on therapeutic moments, and in the 11th hour at 11:30 at night go to bed. In that moment, we have reacted to our feeling, and we will have to clean that up because we just displayed an incongruency in our approach. As long as you clean it up, we are human. Those moments are going to happen. And it is in the cleanup that we regain not only the community, the congruency, but we actually advance the relationship. In that moment of apology and clarity, the relationship just grew.
Yeah. Switching gears a little bit, looking at, because we've been at the Issues of Substance Conference in Montreal, the National Addictions Treatment Conference, seeing what you've seen and having the conversations you've had, if you had to pick one thing to change about the current state of addictions treatment in Canada, what would that be? What would that look like?
There's so many, Jeff. Where to
start? No. Well, we'll start with one, and we'll see where it goes.
We'll let it. The one thing, we need to have evaluation. We need to have outcomes developed to not only validate but that what we're doing is good, but also to hold us accountable for just not throwing a program out there and it may or may not be good. At the same time, the danger is that research, that outcomes becomes the program. And the reality is every addict is different. Every person who comes to our program is different. And no one research methodology is going to hit every client. So I think the piece I would see is that we need to maintain a multiplicity of program offerings. And it needs to be oriented towards the client. Rather than to an academic approach. One example for me is to have clear modules makes it easy to say this is how we guarantee that every program's delivering a quality breadth of addiction information. What we've found with the clients that we take is the psychoed model is not received very well. It's an information sharing, yes, and there is room for it, but it allows them to stay outside of looking at what's really emotionally going on inside of them. And in some cases, it can give them the language they need to keep people away because they can talk.
They can intellectualize the issue,
yes,
and rationalize it,
yeah,
but they don't necessarily experience it.
Yeah.
And,
So I think, of course, I'm biased, but I think the putting them in the experience, actually in the practice, expecting that mistakes are going to happen. In fact, if mistakes aren't happening, then we probably aren't hitting the core issues.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, if treatment's going well, then it's probably not. Right, you need to have those crises and those moments of
absolutely.
Of
breakthrough. If you don't have a breakdown, you can't have a breakthrough. I would even go further and say, the larger the breakdown, the larger the potential breakthrough. Now, the onus is on us to have the relationship and the program design intentionality, so that they just aren't random breakdowns.
Yeah.
and that the client still has full control, which is an interesting word for addicts, full control of choice, whether they want to go there or not.
Okay. Circling back a little bit to your staff team, you know, you've worked decades now in the field. You've seen lots of staff come and go in a wide range of programs. Aside from things like vulnerability and the ability to be on a shared journey or the acknowledgement that they're on a shared journey, what are some of the skills, beliefs, attitudes that you've noticed over the years that separate excellent staff from staff who either aren't going to make it in the field or are mediocre and, you know, they're not necessarily getting the outcomes that you would want for clients? Is there anything?
They have to have a passion. They have to have a passion that's greater than their career. They have to be able to work within a team and to accept that there's other strengths to learn from in that team. I prefer the roving leadership model, where if you've got a well-rounded team, then there's going to be somebody who naturally is a better leader at any given moment. And to have a team that's willing to release their ego enough to let somebody else step in and to look for where they can best support that and fill the gap, that's when things run the smoothest. A hierarchical approach, a top-down management, that won't work. One, it doesn't work with the clients. So why do we try and impose it on the staff team?
Yeah. It seems to be a natural organizational tendency, especially as organizations get bigger, to move more towards hierarchy and bureaucracy.
Well, it's interesting. Some of the things that I often look at is you have to really look at, is this going to make life easier? And a lot of times trying to fill people's time with efficiency, you end up creating systems that end up driving the bus. And people then fill all their time meeting systems rather than being on the floor with the clients engaged. In the beginning, I know there was some resistance to this notion that we just invite clients into a conversation. It was like, well, if I don't tell them to get out of bed, they won't. And it makes it, in the beginning, look like, so it would be much easier if we just tell them what they need to do. In reality, those kind of power struggles give the client something external to fight, rather than what we're trying to do and is get them to look within.
Yeah, they're on an inner journey, and
yeah,
the less you give them external to themselves to focus on, the more powerful you're.
The other reality is they've got all day to concentrate on that battle. We've filled our staff with tons of requirements, documentation, roles, tasks that they have to do. The clients are going to win that battle, and it's going to cost you more time, more negative energy in the long term than if you just embrace the reducing that power differential. And we've found that it has gotten lots easier. There's still going to be struggles, and it does require staff to enter into conversations. If you don't follow through on the conversations, then that will create a whole nother batch of issues. But there's 100 examples I could give along those lines where I'll give one.
Sure, I know, that's great.
Like music. Yeah. That's been one of the biggest struggles. Why can't we listen to the music we like to listen to? If staff just say, nope, we're just listening to this music, period, and they censor it, there may be good therapeutic reason for that, but if the clients aren't involved collaboratively in what those reasons are, it's going to just look like a pure power move where adult voluntary, you say that over here, and yet in music, you just arbitrarily take it away. So our solution, hard fought to get there, was we do a therapeutic music group. So rather than just saying our program has no music, which some places just get to, that's to make staff life easier.
Yeah.
We have a therapeutic music group that looks at, so music has been a strong part of your life, but that also means it's been a strong part of your using life. If music's important to you, what music supports your recovery life? And then they put together, offer music that they think will support them in their recovery journey. We cut CDs with that music, and then that creates a library, but each new group of clients gets to kind of tweak that, but it always comes through the lens of a therapeutic music group that still allows staff to hold a shunda culture that we don't have misogynistic music, but it allows us to then actually have that conversation of what is misogynistic music and how does that serve you and what does that say about your relationships, etc. So there, it doesn't mean that whatever they come up with goes, but you have to have the conversation before anything to go.
It sounds like you guys have really embraced this evolutionary process at the program level, where, you know, it's never done. You know, Shunda, the program is never kind of sealed off, and this is the music we're going to listen to from now into perpetuity. It's something that you're willing to revisit with each new client and each new client group.
Yeah, and in fact, that's critical. It's because currently I run most of the community meetings. I've heard the music argument maybe 60 times over the last 6 years. What I've found from my experience in many different settings, many different group homes, is many rules are put in place because staff are just tired of dealing with the same issue over and over again, and it's easier to just say, let's just end this issue, we don't do that here. The reality I try to bring up is, yes, you've heard it 10 times. For this client group, this is their first time through the process. That's meeting the client where they're at, and the onus is on us to, in a way, if we can get into the framework of this is their first process, then we can engage it, and so what if it's 10 times? It's their first time.
Oh, and really it's the staff's first process with that client group, and so it's a new learning experience, a new opportunity. I know we've had to take the broom to a few rules at Basecamp that developed over the years and just became truth. This is how we do things. And we had to look at it and say, is this actually therapeutic? Is this actually client-centered? And when you do that, you know, most of the rules kind of melt away a little bit and are replaced with a process of engagement with clients that you guys certainly model well at Shunda.
Yeah, and we do have, I mean, we are adult voluntary, so we can do things a little different, but safety rules are safety rules, and they'll probably be the same at every program. Those remain, and those are non-negotiable. Then we have what we call consistencies, and that's how the program runs. When do we get up? What kind of groups do we run? That's fully open to change through the process of community meetings so that we can maintain an integrity of informing and communication so everyone's on the same page. We also have mandate rules, which are rules that come down from accreditation, etc., that may not fall in the realm of safety, but we're still committed and compelled to follow them. What the clients do need to hear, though, is not just, no, we can't do it. They need to hear the reasons around it and that's why it is what it is, but those are still end up non-negotiable because they're mandate rules. We added one other that's kind of a bridge between consistency where anything's open to change, and that are cultural mandates. And those are pieces that we've just decided are critical to treatment. One example for, remember, we're adult voluntary, but each client has their own room. It would be perfectly reasonable for another adult voluntary client to say, why can't I play cards with so-and-so in their room? We're having a good one-on-one conversation. But we've chosen that for a therapeutic reason, the hardest conversation an addict is going to have is with themselves. That's why they have their own room. That long, deep night is often where that conversation takes place. So that becomes, for therapeutic reasons, we want to maintain that integrity of this is your room alone. Obviously, a co-ed program has it more for a mandate safety rule.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. We should call it here, maybe at the airport. We'll sit down and chat a little bit more. We should probably catch a taxi from the hotel.
Groovy.
To the airport. All right, here we are, finally reconnecting after, I don't know, 6 months since we sat down in November?
Easily
6 months. So I'm here with Jeff Wilson, and we are going to finish off a little podcast interview that we started way back in Montreal at the Issues of Substance conference, talking about addiction and mental health treatment. And we've been, so let's just pick up where we left off, which I think was kind of your advice to professionals in the field, young professionals, old professionals, but what should they be doing to set themselves up for success in the field?
Oh, that's a huge question, because there is a lot of skill development that happens over time, but I think the attitude going in is probably the critical ingredient. It is all about relationship and all its facets, and a couple of kind of worldviews that you can bring in are an open curiosity into everything. You are not the expert. Only the client can be an expert for their experience and what they need. You can be there certainly to inquire with them, help them solidify things, offer opportunities to share with them. Perhaps staying well grounded in exploring personally what you don't know, you don't know. We often feel like our job is to know, to be the expert. But I think beyond the obvious safety, trauma-informed work we have to do with clients, the key piece is we have lots of room to just exercise compassionate inquiry and curiosity.
And not just with clients, but with ourselves.
With ourselves, with our teammates, with the world at large. I mean, firmly believe the shared journey, that you have to be on your own journey of self-discovery, self-awareness, if you're going to be able to be curious with another human being about their journey of self-awareness.
And you were a part recently of putting together a 2-day shared journey training for Enviros that I unfortunately wasn't able to participate in, but I heard great things about it. Can you give us a bit of an overview of what that training looked like, some of the things you guys did? I know there were horses involved. It sounded like a very comprehensive kind of experience for folks, but what stands out for you that was surprising or affirmed things that you already knew about this idea of a shared journey?
I think there were a lot of people involved in delivering it. I think the part that stands out for me is that people have a natural curiosity, that they have a natural passion to learn about themselves and to learn with other people. And if you can provide the opportunity, in this case, the horses provided that outside relationship ability for people, but the reality is that was 2 hours of a two-day workshop. The bulk of the work was done in just exploring, getting grounded in your own senses, how you perceive things, what you're feeling, just to be able to take 2 days to concentrate on who you are and what's occurring for you in any given experience is, it's rare. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I guess the reminder that that's so incredibly important, and we get carried away in the busyness of work and life and task-oriented to spend the time in that critical exploration mode needs to happen.
Cool. So what advice would you have someone who's at the peak of your career, really, starting up and managing Shunda Creek Addiction Treatment Program? You've had experience in the past supervising programs in this role. What should managers do differently? What do you see that managers, supervisors, administrators need to do in order to create the environment and create the atmosphere for staff to do the kind of exploration that you're talking about? Because you're right, we get task focused and we get very kind of make sure you get your documents done and make sure you deliver this treatment group, and it doesn't create often the space for it. So what are some of the things that you either do at Shunda or you think could be applicable to programs and administrators wherever they are?
Okay, I'd say the things that I'm still attempting to do better are how to coach other people in the moment, in their action. I've always been good at high levels of trust and release of responsibility. There has to be an equal measure of holding folks accountable in the way of bringing the learning back to them more immediately. And not just let things ride a bit. But I do think as managers, it's difficult to release that accountability. And yet it's critical, or you're going to end up with a team that just does what they think they're supposed to do as opposed to think for themselves and take some form of at-stake actions as opposed to at-risk actions.
Can you flush those out? Because I don't think people understand.
Okay, at stake is what you stand to gain by stepping into a little bit of uncomfortableness or a little bit of unknown, not unsure of the outcome. But you've done some due diligence around it. You have a skill base around it. But you still know that, ooh, I'm not really sure how this is going to turn out. I've got a pretty good feel, and I've got some tools in case it starts to go sideways. And at risk would be what you stand to gain. If you're focused on
what you
this could
lose.
Go bad, yeah. Then you're going to avoid stepping into the uncomfortable or taking the chance for the big payoff. Now, if you have a non-judgmental relationship with your clients, I would venture that if you're truly in relationship with them, they know you aren't going to judge them, and there's a trust built up. There's very little that you risk in trying to go for gold. As long as you're approaching, I don't know what I don't know, and you're open and you're listening, and there is solid relationship, the worst that can happen is you have to apologize by owning your own crap. Trauma-informed makes that a little sketchier, potentially. On the other hand, everybody has had trauma. And I'm not minimizing the depth of some people's trauma. I'm just saying it's a human condition. So if you're involved in relationship with another human being and it's an equal, where you've really monitored your power differentials, then I still think that's our job, is to go in there.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about power? And I know that you guys have been thinking about power differential a lot since the kind of formation of the program, being adult voluntary, being different than even adolescent voluntary and or any other mandated program where there's a very clear power hierarchy at play. And I know you guys have taken great strides to try and minimize that power hierarchy, but what are some of the things that you guys think about power and how that influences or informs the work?
Okay, well, here's a few adapted pieces that we've taken from Cedar Barstow and the Right Use of Power. And one of our therapists, Serena Rose, was a trainer for that. So we are not Right Use of Power, but a few pieces that we've taken that seem to work for us are recognizing the inherent, that just inherent in being a staff in a program with a vulnerable sector, even though they have voluntarily come, we do have an inherent power. That's always going to be there as an adult, as a wilderness instructor who holds more of the information around safety. We're always going to be in a bit of an up power position. The goal is to try to bring the clients as much personal efficacy and power as possible within that relationship, and to have it clear where we do need to be in power, for instance, following policies, mandates. But instead of it being because we said so, it can be an explanation of this is a policy, this is a mandate. We may even agree with them that it's a little silly, but to at least have it as an understood, they will grant. In essence, you're entering into a conversation where they're granting you the ability to maintain that power because they understand.
It's a negotiation of power as opposed to an imposing of power.
That's a very good way of saying that.
Excellent. Cool. I know you've got a session here. We're actually at a Woods Homes Research Symposium, and you've got a session coming up in no time. So any parting thoughts for listeners? Anything, any one action step that whoever's listening could take on any of these things that we've talked about?
I'll give a quote I gave at an Enviros program 20 years ago. When you come to work, leave your ego at the door.
Perfect. Excellent advice. Thanks, Jack. I hope you enjoyed this two-part interview over the course of the last year with Jeff Wilson. And I do apologize to Jeff that it took me this long to get it out the door. But some very excellent words of wisdom from someone I admire very, very much. Thanks, Jeff. And thank you all for listening. And don't forget to check out Shifting Perspective, which is our conference that Enviros and Mount Royal University are putting on together in April 2017, so just a few short months away. You can learn more at www.shiftingperspective.ca. And I do believe that registration is open, so make sure you grab a ticket. All right, catch you next week.